Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. At Ukraine's stricken Chernobyl nuclear plant, staff that have been working there non-stop since the Russian invasion have finally been able to return home. The development on Monday followed deep concern expressed over staff welfare there by Mario Grossi, head of the UN Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA. In a statement on Sunday, Mr. Grossi said that they'd been carrying out their important work under immensely stressful and tiring conditions in the presence of foreign military forces and without proper rest. Staying with Ukraine, the UN Rights Office, OHCHR, has reported that more than 900 civilians have been confirmed killed and nearly 1,500 injured since the Russian attack. Most of the victims were hit by shelling from heavy artillery, multiple rocket launch systems, missiles and airstrikes, although the true figure is likely far higher, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights said in its latest update. Getting verifiable information about reports of numerous civilian casualties is proving difficult from many Ukrainian cities and regions which are still being pounded by Russian shelling, OHCHR stressed. In Democratic People's Republic of Korea, DPRK, more commonly known as North Korea, human rights violations remain systematic and the authorities' grip on the population has tightened, the Human Rights Council heard on Monday. The forum's UN-appointed independent expert, Thomas Quintana, reported that the situation had worsened because of COVID-19 prevention measures, exacerbating a humanitarian crisis.
Chronic food insecurity continues to be widespread in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, with the numbers of food insecure people consistently above 10 million, representing over 40% of the country's population.
Prolonged border closures and restrictions on movement have shut down markets that many people use to get the basics, the rights expert warned. He also highlighted the policy of shooting individuals who attempt to enter or leave the country without permission, in reference to buffer zones set up on the border with China and Russia. The DPRK delegation was present at the Human Rights Council, but declined to respond to the report. Climate issues now and a warning to the world's richest nations from UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres on Monday that the target of keeping global temperatures to within 1.5 degrees of pre-industrial levels is on life support. The problem is and has always been the enormous emissions gap that's created in the main by industrialized countries, Mr. Guterres told the Economist Sustainability Summit in a fresh appeal to achieve a 45% reduction in global emissions by 2030 and carbon neutrality by 2050.
Last year alone, global energy-related CO2 emissions grew by 6% to their highest level in history. Coal emissions have surged to record highs. We are sleepwalking to climate catastrophe.
Mr. Guterres told the summit that the planet has already warmed by as much as 1.2 degrees and that climate disasters in 2020 had forced 30 million people from their homes. He urged developed countries, development banks and the private sector to unite to deliver green technology to emerging economies that are so reliant on coal for their energy. And as Russia's war in Ukraine continues to unfold, Mr. Guterres also warned against any short-term measures that countries were considering as an alternative to Russian fossil fuels. These stopgap policies would only close the window to the 1.5-degree target, the UN Secretary-General insisted, in a call to massively increase climate finance to the tune of trillions of dollars. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, it's worth our while to think about why practically everyone you know is talking about Ukraine and Russia's unlawful incursion. And it's equally worthwhile to ask why those same principles of concern don't seem to apply in other cases. Those feelings, after all, don't have to fight one another. But to hear Yemen put forward as a meme, as just an example of an under-considered concern, is galling from the same people who under-prioritized it in the first place. Yemen is not a rhetorical device. It's a country of human beings in crisis in which the United States is deeply involved. We'll talk about that with Yemeni activist and advocate Shireen Al-Adeimi. She's also assistant professor of education at Michigan State University. Also on the show, Sarah Bloom Raskin was up for a job at the Federal Reserve. Everyone was for her nomination, including the bankers that she would oversee. So why did she withdraw her nomination, and what does that tell us about the possibility of making any advances at all in addressing the reality of climate change? Helping us see why issues that media often divide are completely related is David Arkish, Managing Director of the Climate Program at the group Public Citizen. That's coming up. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. It's encouraging to see widespread recognition of the double standards of concern from media and politicians that we see reflected in the earnest attention to Ukraine as compared to that devoted to other areas of crisis, like Yemen. 7 years now under a Saudi-led war and blockade, enabled by weapons and technical assistance from the United States and others, that's leaving hundreds of thousands of people in hunger and need. While we're using that critical lens, we can also see that it's only media framing and its social media echoes that insist that you quantify your compassion in the first place. And they're mainly interested in how your concern shows up as consuming more media. So while acknowledgement of official double standards and hypocrisy is welcome, the point is lost if you come away seeing Yemen as a rhetorical device, rather than a country of 30 million people enduring a protracted cataclysm in which this country, the United States, is playing a central role. Here to talk about Yemen in its own right is Shireen Al-Adeimi. She's assistant professor of education at Michigan State University and has been working for years to raise awareness on Yemen and human rights. She joins us now by phone from Lansing. Welcome back to Counterspin, Shireen Al-Adeimi.
Thanks so much for having me back, Janine.
Well, we've seen the cold facts. Yemen war deaths, we're told, will reach 377,000 by the end of the year, the UN says. The UN's described it for years as the world's worst humanitarian disaster. It's difficult to convey or to get your mind around a place where a child is dying of starvation every 75 seconds, you know. So first we just sit with that. But I wanted to actually start with where we've left off in our previous conversations, which is that when people see the suffering in Yemen, the message is not, please come and intervene and save us. That's not what people are asking for.
Yeah. Actually, the numbers that you mentioned, those were 377,000 deaths at the end of last year, 2021.
Right.
And so these deaths have just been mounting ever since. And even that number, I'm afraid, is a large underestimate of really the humanitarian toll and the loss that Yemenis have experienced and have continued to experience over the last 7 years. But absolutely, the ask here is not, oh, look at us, come save us from this big, bad person, the Saudi Arabians and the UAE. The ask here is to stop U.S. intervention, to stop piling on to the invasion, the bombing, the starvation, this incredibly devastating war and onslaught that Yemenis have undergone over the past 7 years. And it's just mind-boggling to me that that simple ask, really, to just pay attention to what our own government is doing in Yemen and to call for an end to that is somehow less worthy of attention than called to, in fact, you know, save us and, right, and give us money and, you know, right? I think it's great that people are paying attention to the humanitarian crisis in Ukraine. We should never support invasions or, you know, attacks on sovereignty. And yet it seems that the attention to that conflict, even though it's much more demanding, I guess, seems to be more easily given than the conflict in Yemen, where Yemenis are asking the U.S. to stop intervening in this conflict and making things worse.
Well, Biden came into office saying that the war on Yemen has to end. You know, you had some questions about that early on, and I wonder how those have borne out. What sense do you make of the White House's actions, not words, but actions on Yemen?
This is the problem with the Biden administration is, you know, when we had Trump in power, his actions were very much aligned with his words. And so he was saying that he wanted to continue bombing Yemen because it was great money for the U.S. because the Saudis paid in cash, right? So it was a big business deal for the U.S. to continue to support that Arabian military and the UAE military in Yemen. But with Biden, even though this war began under the Biden-Obama administration, there was a lot of talk on his campaign trail to end the war. Like you said, he said, this war must end. I will stop selling weapons. I will make them a pariah that they are. They're going and killing innocent women and children. And these are quotes from his presidential debate in 2019. And then his first foreign policy speech in February of 2021 was that he was going to put an end to this war. And he introduced this dichotomy that didn't exist before, which is that he's going to end offensive operations and that he was going to review relevant arms sales. And that's what Sarah Lazar and I in these times picked up on the same day that he made the announcement on February 4th, 2021, questioning what this means and whether he's just introduced these loopholes to continue, in fact, supporting the Saudi-led coalition, but instead calling it defensive instead of offensive. And I'm sad to say that this is exactly what has panned out. The actions of the Biden administration are really no different than the actions of the Trump administration or the Obama administration. They continue to support the Saudi-led coalition. They continue to support with weapons and logistics and intelligence, but they're just calling it defensive now, even though it makes absolutely no sense. And there have been no clarifications provided to Congress when they've asked. But it gives them this plausible deniability, I suppose, to say, well, we're not actually involved in Yemen anymore. We're just helping for defensive purposes.
Right. Well, it's interesting even to rhetorically gesture to say, I'm going to move to end the war in Yemen, suggests U.S. centrality, suggests a U.S. role there, which in terms of news media is not always acknowledged. It's always a Saudi-led war, a Saudi-perpetrated war, and it's not that the U.S. role is denied completely, but the fact that a president can say, I'm going to move to end this war, shows that he could do something to end the war. I'm not sure that media really always place the U.S. in that way. We're seen as, like, not bystanders, but helping in some way or the other, but not as central as, in fact, we are. You wouldn't think that the U.S. had the power actually to end the war.
Absolutely. I mean, that statement is an admission of how involved the U.S. is in this war. I just have to lay it out to the audience in case they're not aware. The Saudi and the UAE military, they are completely incompetent and entirely dependent on U.S. support. And what I mean by that is they rely on U.S. contracts with their militaries and air forces to train their pilots, train their soldiers, to provide logistical support. You know, up until 2018, which was during the Trump administration, late 2018, the U.S. was providing mid-air refueling to Saudi and Emirati jets. We supply them with all of their weaponry because they don't manufacture anything and they import everything that they have from mostly the U.S., about 70% from the U.S., but then also countries like the U.K., Canada, and other Western countries, not from Russia and China because those weapon systems are different. They rely on, you know, Western governments to supply them with arms. Then there's the intelligence sharing, and there's support in the command room choosing targets for them. So every step of the way, the pilot who was flying a U.S.-made plane has been trained by U.S. personnel. His plane, after he drops U.S. bombs, ends up getting serviced, continues to get serviced by U.S. personnel. Spare parts are provided by the U.S. Those targets were chosen with the support of the U.S. So every step of the way, the U.S. is helping and facilitating and enabling this coalition to continue bombing Yemen. And then, of course, we're not even talking about things like diplomatic cover at the U.N. and support for the blockade and things like that. And so without the U.S., this war really can't go on, and at least can't go on in the way it has been for the last several years. Not to this extent. It couldn't cause as much damage to the Yemeni people. without U.S. support. And then, you know, diplomatically, Biden can pick up the phone and, you know, I've spoken to Congress people who understand this. You know, Biden can call up the Saudi crown prince and just say, listen, you need to end this war, and the war will end, you know, because the U.S. has such leverage with the Saudis and with the Emiratis. But the fact of the matter is that the U.S. is really a party to the war, and they don't want to end this war because they are a party to the war. They're engaged in hostilities, and yet they've enjoyed this PR campaign, essentially, of it being called the Saudi-led coalition and not the U.S.-led war in Yemen.
Well, let me just ask you finally, your work is about how people learn, and that brings us, I think, to news media in a way. And I think there's an issue with just topic segregation. In other words, you can pick up a paper and see an empathetic story about Yemeni children, for example, about suffering. And then on a different page in the paper, you can find a story about MBS, you know, and how he's a down-to-earth guy who loves dogs, about the Saudi leader. So there's a separation in news media from things that might tug at heartstrings, might make you feel empathy, and then things that seem actionable, things that seem like something you can do. So I would just ask you finally, I know that the attention that the war on Ukraine is giving to Yemen is kind of backhanded attention, but that doesn't mean we can't use a spotlight when we have it. And so what can people be for right now? What are places to push for listeners to do at this moment who are concerned about the U.S. actions in Yemen?
You know, I don't blame the average person for feeling a certain way about Ukraine and not having that same empathy for Yemen, because, like you said, the media really manipulates the way we understand issues, and it decontextualizes so much of this stuff. And so somebody might be looking at this and not understanding that, you know, we are Putin in this case.
Right.
We are, the Saudis are like Putin. We are the aggressor. The U.S. is the aggressor in this case. We are the people who are causing the starvation because it's so decontextualized. But we can talk and chew gum at the same time. Like, we can pay attention to what's going on in Ukraine and also not stall on our action toward Yemen, especially because in this case, you know, it's not about different people fighting a war that we're not involved in. We are central to this war, like we've discussed. And so right now there's some movement in Congress. It's been really difficult to get Democrats energized in the same way that they were energized during the Trump administration, because I think they were giving President Biden the benefit of the doubt, mm-hmm. but they understand now that the U.S. is just as involved as they were before. And there is a push by Representatives Jayapal and DeFazio to introduce another war powers resolution. It wouldn't end weapon sales, but it would force Biden to end U.S. support for the war mm-hmm. in Yemen. And I'm disappointed that it's not getting as much attention, because, again, it seems like Ukraine has taken up a lot more attention. And, you know, again, they can pay attention to these things equally, given our role especially. But I would love for listeners to call their representatives and to urge them to support a Yemen War Powers Resolution, to come on as co-sponsors when the bill is introduced, to really make these public statements of support for an end to the U.S.'s war in Yemen. Understand that this is our responsibility as citizens of the U.S. to continue to push our elected officials to demand really from them to take a stance on this humanitarian crisis that continues to be a stain on U.S. history.
We've been speaking with Shireen Aladimi, Assistant Professor of Education at Michigan State University. You can find her writing on Yemen and other issues, among other places, at inthesetimes.org. Shireen Aladimi, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me, Janine.
The disjuncture between what really day-to-day matters in the lives of people around the country, food, shelter, work you can live on, and what elected officials do is the stuff of political science. We all know that the connection isn't direct. People want health care, for instance. When they have to choose between their medicine and keeping the lights on, nobody's saying, yay, this is a choice I made that redounds overall to my benefit. But when it comes to media coverage, people and their needs and their problems often get subsumed into an abstract story about economic interests and industry and government and blah, blah, blah. journalism could provide a different connection between human needs and policy decisions that might spur action rather than frustration. And it seems as though a failure to connect those dots is part of why a candidate for a position at the Federal Reserve, Sarah Bloom Raskin, had her nomination derailed because her record indicated that she recognized that climate disruption is real and will have economic impacts. So what happened here is the sausages being made, and there's a reason that the joke is that you don't want to see it. But we have to see it if we want to be the democracy of, by, and for the people we claim we want to be. David Arkish is the Managing Director of Public Citizens Climate Program and a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, David Arkish.
Thanks, Janine. Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's start at the center here. Sarah Bloom Raskin was up for Federal Reserve Vice Chair for Supervision.
Mm-hmm.
She was confirmed by the White House, obviously, but by others as well. So what happened?
That's a great question. And, you know, your introduction had me thinking, you know, there's one thing worse than seeing how the sausage gets made, and that is seeing it fail to be made up close. This is a job, I'll start with maybe a little background on what this role is. So the position of vice chair for supervision at the Federal Reserve was created after the financial crisis of 2008, when Congress passed that big bill, the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Act. One of the pieces in it was creating this position at the Fed so that there would be a high-up official at the Fed monitoring the safety of banks and monitoring the stability of the financial system and looking out, looking at the horizon for emerging risks and figuring out what to do about it. Now, Sarah Bloom Raskin, it is hard to think of a person who is better suited to that job. She's the most qualified person in the country that I know of by far. She is a former state bank regulator. She was the supervisor of banks in Maryland and the top financial regulator in Maryland. She has already been on the board of the Federal Reserve, which this vice chair for supervision is one of the governors on the board.
Right.
She's already been one. And she was the number two person at the Treasury. So she has high-level experience. At Treasury, she led work on cybersecurity risks to finance. So she's actually also the nation's leading expert on cybersecurity threats to financial institutions and to financial stability, something that would squarely be within her jurisdiction at the Federal Reserve, and something that is a really heightened concern right now given the war between Russia and Ukraine, that we are actually facing heightened cyber threats on critical infrastructure in this country, including banks and the finance system. So it's really hard to imagine somebody who is more qualified. Now, one of the things that somebody who is that qualified and that expert thinks about in the context of making sure that we have a sound economy and a sound financial system right now is climate. It is impossible to ignore that, you know, climate harms are imposing really severe costs on a lot of sectors, on a lot of whole states, on a lot of geographies. There are insurers who are pulling out of insuring homes in large regions of California. These things have major economic impacts, and it's also hard to ignore that there are a lot of climate-related risks to financial institutions and to financial stability. And that is basically a consensus view among most financial regulators these
right.
days.
Right.
And Sarah Bloom Raskin also agrees with that view and was very clear that she intended not to ignore things that were related to climate, as there is often pressure to do in the United States because of our bizarre politics and the power of the fossil fuel industry, but that she would look at those risks the same way she would look at any others and take them on if need be in regard to how they affect banks and how they affect finance.
Which businesses and banks should want, right? I mean, they're reality-based organizations, as we understand them to be. So what was it about what she said, matter-of-factly, about climate disruption and its impact that was the problem?
Well, this is what's surprising and unusual about this situation, Sarah Blue Mask, in addition to all the other things I have said, has already been confirmed twice by the U.S. Senate. She wouldn't have been on the Fed board, and she wouldn't have been the number two at Treasury if she hadn't been. Twice confirmed unanimously. And this time around, she also had broad bipartisan support. She's supported by consumer groups, by civil rights groups, by unions, by many businesses, and by banks, by big banks and small banks. Everyone, you know, it's a really uncommon thing to find somebody who virtually everybody agrees is actually extremely expert, competent, and reasonable. There was one major group that does not agree, and that is the oil and gas industry. And not even the whole oil and gas industry. It's interesting, having seen the fight up close, the large oil companies didn't bother. It was small oil and gas companies who were opposed. And it's not hard to figure out why. If you pay attention to these issues, a lot of the smaller oil and gas companies are in pretty shaky financial condition. Some of them have never been profitable, you know, over the 10 or 15-year history of the company. And oil and gas markets are really volatile. Everybody knows this. Prices go up, prices go down. And it's really hard for them to get loans, in part because of a combination of how basically the companies are just really risky and all the financial institutions know it, and they have trouble getting bank loans. And so oil and gas has, for a long time, pressured financial regulators, pressured bank regulators to adopt essentially biased rules that either give them directly sort of special bailouts or favors, or pressure banks to lend to companies that the banks think are too risky. And one thing that was clear about Sarah Blum Raskin is she was not going to do that. Right? She was going to take a measured, serious, expert approach. And she's well within the mainstream of what any honest and competent regulator should and would do, and frankly most do, particularly under one side of the aisle here. But, you know, she had said some things about recognizing the threats from climate risks to finance and to banks, and her opponents just seized on that. And I think we all know what often happens in U.S. politics. If you start painting somebody as a climate radical, she very quickly lost in the U.S. Senate the support of basically every Republican and Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia. Ultimately, that was the end of her nomination, basically on the basis of her having viewpoints that are completely mainstream and reasonable. The chair of the Fed, who is a Republican, Chair Powell, agrees with and is about to sail through his confirmation. But in her case, they were used, you know, basically to smear her and treat her like she was some kind of radical.
Well, let me just ask you finally for your thoughts about media coverage, because when I looked at the coverage, I saw a reference to Blum Raskin as embattled. And, you know, when you hear that word or that kind of language, it makes it sound as though, you know, the jury was out. It was kind of 50-50 and she was on the losing side. What you're telling me is there was a whole lot of support and understanding, and then there was a faction that was able kind of to whipsaw the rest. So if people are reading journalism, media coverage about this, and they want to really understand what happened, maybe embattled isn't going to really tell them the story in the way that they should understand it. So I would just ask you finally, what would you like to see journalists doing more of or less of in terms of not just this nomination, but in terms of the relationship between climate disruption and financial regulation?
Well, that's interesting. It is a big topic. I think that people do need to hear more about it and understand more about it. It couldn't be more obvious. Again, it's very quickly becoming totally uniform among financial regulators to be taking it seriously, and lots of them are acting on the issue. And frankly, a lot of the private sector is, right? A lot of the big banks are, a lot of the big asset managers are. I think the coverage has been improving. Frankly, it's a new area. A lot of people haven't heard about, you know, the idea that there's a connection between climate change and finance, although once, you know, the moment you start talking to people about it, it's obvious that it's right, and there is, and that we ought to be thinking about it. And so, you know, it's catching on very quickly. But I think, yeah, increased awareness of that, increased awareness of the seriousness of the risks and what needs to be done. And that's sort of on the issue in general. And then I think in terms of, like, this type of political fight, I started thinking toward the end of it that the U.S. Senate is such a strange institution and it's so undemocratic,
right,
in a society that has such a long and proud tradition of democracy in so many ways, that is not one of them. And almost everything that happens there needs to be painstakingly contextualized as happening in this sort of bizarre alternate reality, yeah. Right? There's a real world in which someone like Sarah Lynn Raskin is supported by basically everybody, including the banks that she's going to regulate and including consumer advocates and civil rights groups and, you know, and unions. And then there's this bizarre world of the U.S. Senate where the representation does not match the population in the United States. What they do does not match public opinion in the United States, and they operate under bizarre rules. And, yeah, what happens there is it's like a parallel universe. And I think sometimes things that happen there get treated as if they're real-world things, or that they reflect real opinions, or that they reflect where the American people are.
Right.
And I think that does some real harm, because it's actually important for us to understand how that institution actually works and, frankly, in my view, how broken it is and how much we need to be taking on that issue as well.
We've been speaking with David Arkesh. He's Managing Director of Public Citizens Climate Program. They're online at citizen.org. David Arkesh, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Jean.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. You can find us online at fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Ukraine has defied Russia's ultimatum that it surrender the besieged city of Mariupol by 5 a.m. Moscow time as attacks and casualties mount on day 26 of Russia's invasion. Mariupol officials said Russian forces bombed an art school Sunday that was sheltering 400 displaced people. Many residents of Mariupol remain trapped amidst heavy Russian bombardment and dwindling supplies.
We have been in a basement for 11 days. This is the 25th day of war. We have been counting every one of them. We hope for the best, to live as humans. The apartment has been broken. Everything is broken. Where can we go from the basement? We're cooking at a fire. For now, we have some food and some firewood. In a week, we will have nothing, no food at all. What should we do?
A powerful blast in the capital, Kyiv, earlier today destroyed a sprawling shopping mall. The number of victims from that attack is not yet known. Meanwhile, Moscow said it used hypersonic missiles twice in its attacks on Ukraine over the weekend. Residents in the city of Sumy were told to take shelter after Russian shelling hit a chemical factory, triggering an ammonia leak. Dozens of staff who've been working under Russian orders at the Chernobyl nuclear plant have been relieved and replaced by other Ukrainian personnel after working for around 600 hours. The UN said some 10 million people have been forced from their homes since the start of Russia's invasion. About a third of those are refugees, while the rest are internally displaced. The World Food Program warned Ukraine's food supply chain is falling apart. Amidst the intensified fighting, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky urged direct talks with Vladimir Putin, but warned if those fail, quote, that would mean this is World War III.
The time has come for a meeting. It is time to talk. The time has come to restore territorial integrity and justice for Ukraine. Otherwise, Russia's losses will be such that it will take you several generations to recover.
Over the weekend, Turkey's foreign minister said Russian and Ukrainian teams made progress on their negotiations to end the war. Zelensky's also suggested Israel could help mediate peace talks between the two countries. President Joe Biden met virtually with Chinese President Xi Jinping on Friday for the first time since Russia's invasion. The White House said Biden warned Xi of consequences if China supports Russia's assault. Xi said Beijing is not planning to back the Kremlin in its war. Germany and Qatar have reached a deal on gas supplies as Berlin seeks to lessen its dependency on Russian energy imports. This comes as reports out of Washington say the Biden administration transferred a large number of Patriot anti-missile interceptors to Saudi Arabia in recent weeks as the U.S. pressures Riyadh to pump more oil. In China, a passenger jet with 132 people aboard has crashed near the southern city of Wuzhou in Guangxi province. State media reports rescue crews were dispatched after the plane crashed in a remote mountainous region, producing a massive fireball. Harrowing footage posted to social media appears to show the jet plummeting vertically towards the ground just moments before impact. A flight tracking website identified the plane as a Boeing 737-800. It's the model that preceded the troubled 737 MAX and has an excellent safety record. China reported two COVID deaths in the northeastern city of Jilin on Saturday, the country's first coronavirus fatality since January of last year. Jilin is the home of some 4.5 million people. It went into lockdown today. Tens of thousands of people across China have been ordered to stay home as the country continues to battle its largest surges of the pandemic. As cases in many Asian and European nations are on the rise, health experts say the BA.2 Omicron variant now accounts for 25% to 30% of new cases in the U.S. This is top White House advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci.
We likely will see an uptick in cases, as we've seen in the European countries, particularly the U.K., where they've had the same situation as we've had now. They have the BA.2. They have a relaxation of some of the restrictions, such as indoor masking, and there's a waning of immunity. Hopefully, we won't see a surge. I don't think we will.
Climate scientists are expressing alarm over record-shattering temperatures set near the Earth's north and south poles in recent days in Antarctica. Some regions soared as much as 90 degrees Fahrenheit above normal over the weekend. Meanwhile, temperatures near the North Pole soared to more than 50 degrees Fahrenheit above average last week, approaching the freezing mark in areas near the North Pole that were still shrouded in around-the-clock winter darkness. At least 25 migrants and refugees drowned after their shipwrecked off the coast of Tunisia Friday. Some 35 passengers remained unaccounted for. Most of the victims were believed to be from Syria and Tunisia. The International Organization for Migration says over 18,000 people have died or disappeared while attempting to cross the Mediterranean to Europe since 2014. The Biden administration has for the first time determined the Burmese military junta committed genocide and crimes against humanity against the Muslim minority Rohingya community. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's announcing the finding today at the U.S. Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. The U.N. reports as many as 10,000 Rohingya were killed by Burmese forces during the 2017 genocide, though some estimates put the death toll at more than twice that number. Another 730,000 Rohingya were forced to flee Burma. Sri Lanka is seeking a bailout from the International Monetary Fund as it reels from its worst financial crisis since achieving independence in 1948. On Sunday, authorities announced two men collapsed and died while waiting in a line for fuel and energy shortages and soaring prices, which have driven the economy to record inflation. Millions of school students had their exams canceled due to a shortage of printing paper. Last week, protesters and opposition leaders marched through the city of Colombo to protest the handling of the crisis by the government of President Gotabaya Rajapaksa and his family. The Prime Minister and the Finance Minister are brothers of President Rajapaksa. This is one of the protesters.
We didn't come here asking to develop the country or any such thing. We can't live anymore. Because of the skyrocketing cost of living, we can't manage with our salary. We came to remove this government and bring a government that will help us.
The United States has suffered another weekend marked by gun violence in Norfolk, Virginia. Two people were shot dead and three injured outside a restaurant Saturday. One of those killed was Sierra Jenkins, a journalist for the Virginian Pilot. In Arkansas, a gunfight at a community car show killed one person and wounded 28 others, including six children. At least three people were shot and killed at a North Carolina hotel. According to the Gun Violence Archive, there have been 107 mass shootings in the U.S. so far this year. South Carolina prisoners sentenced to death can now be executed by firing squad. Prison officials said Friday they're ready to carry out such executions after Governor Henry McMaster signed a bill last year which forces prisoners to choose between execution by firing squad or electric chair if the drugs needed to perform a lethal injection are unavailable. South Carolina joins three other states which also allow firing squad executions: Mississippi, Oklahoma, and Utah. In Washington, D.C., confirmation hearings start today for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, President Biden's pick for the U.S. Supreme Court. The former public defender would be the first black woman to sit on the Supreme Court. Jackson has received bipartisan support for previous judicial positions, but in recent days, Republican senators have attacked her over her record, accusing her of being overly lenient. In related news, Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas was hospitalized Friday with flu-like symptoms. The court said Thomas, who is currently the longest-serving justice, was diagnosed with an infection, but that it is not COVID-19. He will not be participating in oral arguments today. In Texas, 175 wildfires have scorched close to 100,000 acres across the state in the past week. The Eastland Complex fire, raging west of the Dallas-Fort Worth area, killed at least one person, destroyed at least 50 homes, and displaced hundreds. And in Los Angeles, climate activists joined indigenous land and water protectors Friday in a march on City National Bank, demanding it divest from the Coastal GasLink pipeline in British Columbia. Leading the protest was Adam McKay, director of the hit Netflix film Don't Look Up. McKay and Hollywood A-listers, including Meryl Streep, Mark Ruffalo, and Leonardo DiCaprio, say they'll pull their money out of City National unless its parent company, the Royal Bank of Canada, ends support for the pipeline that's being built on sovereign Wet'suwet'en First Nations land. Indigenous activist George Funmaker also joined Friday's protest.
This pipeline threatens their drinking water and the air and all the other detrimental effects of drilling and the pipeline, like many other poor communities here in Los Angeles who's affected by the oil refineries and the bad air. So just in that same sense, the Wet'suwet'en people are fighting for clean air and clean water, clean land.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping spoke for nearly 2 hours Friday, with much of the discussion focused on Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Biden reportedly warned Xi that China will face consequences if it provides material support to Russia. It was the first call between the two leaders of the world's two largest economies in 4 months. In February, Russian President Vladimir Putin traveled to Beijing for talks with Xi ahead of the invasion. Earlier this month, China joined India, Iran, Pakistan, and 32 other nations from the global south in abstaining from a United Nations vote condemning Russia's war in Ukraine. On Saturday, China's vice foreign minister criticized NATO as a, quote, Cold War vestige, and criticized Western sanctions on Russia, saying globalization is being used as a weapon. To look more at China's evolving relations with both Russia and the United States, we're joined by Alfred McCoy, professor of history at University of Wisconsin-Madison, author of numerous books, most recently To Govern the Globe, World Orders and Catastrophic Change. His recent article for The Nation is headlined, Russia and China Together at Last. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Professor McCoy. Why don't you start off by responding to the talk that President Biden and Xi Jinping had on Friday, what we learned of what they said?
Apparently, what President Biden was hoping to accomplish in his phone conversation with Xi Jinping was to draw on their successful video meeting last November and kind of encourage or even pressure President Xi to back away from China's strong support for Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And that did not happen. President Xi's quote, the most memorable, the most important quote, was he wanted the United States to untie the knot of Ukrainian and Russian security. And that was a kind of oblique reference to the idea that the United States and NATO are responsible for Russia's invasion of Ukraine by expanding NATO right up to the borders of Russia and threatening Russian security. And that's also a reference to the historic meeting between Putin and Xi Jinping on February 4th of this year, when the two met during the Winter Olympics, and they issued an historic 5,300-word declaration that laid claim to establishing a kind of new global order, to attacking U.S. global hegemony, and to build upon their strong bilateral alliance, their very close economic integration in the field of energy, and to simultaneously block NATO from threatening Russia and block the United States from supporting Taiwan against China's legitimate claims to Taiwan. And so, in effect, what that meeting failed to accomplish was it simply failed to break this emerging alliance between China and Russia, which is literally shaking the current world order.
I wanted to turn to Chenggang, the Chinese ambassador to the United States, appearing on CBS's Face the Nation Sunday. He was questioned by Margaret Brennan.
Has Xi Jinping, your president, told Vladimir Putin to stop the invasion? Do you condemn it?
Actually, on the second day of Russia's military operation, President Xi Jinping did talk to President Putin.
Was that their last phone call?
Asking President Putin to think about resuming peace talks with Ukraine. And President Putin listened to it, and we have seen four rounds of peace talks you know, have happened. Let me continue. You know, China's trusted relations with Russia is not a liability. Actually, it's an asset in the international efforts to solve the crisis in a peaceful way. You know, and China is part of the solution. It's not part of the problem.
Professor McCoy, can you respond to the significance of what the Chinese ambassador to the United States said?
Of course. He's, again, kind of affirming what President Xi said in that meeting last Friday with President Biden. In essence, that China is not going to rupture its relations with Russia. It's not going to apply pressure on Russia. It's not going to blame Russia. It's not going to call the Russian invasion of Ukraine an invasion. And it is going to affirm that Russia has legitimate security concerns in Ukraine that must be met, and that if China is going to do anything, it is going to apply its considerable international power and prestige to support Russia in establishing its security in Eastern Europe. what I think what's going on more broadly is that we're seeing a sense of extraordinary confidence from Moscow and Beijing that literally history and, more importantly, geopolitics is on their side. They believe that their alliance gives them such dominance, such power on the massive Eurasian landmass that they can prevail, that they can not only dominate the landmass, they can dominate international politics. In essence, they are pursuing a geopolitical strategy to break U.S. control over the Eurasian landmass and thereby break U.S. global power. They think that they are witnessing the birth, the historic birth of a new world order in which the great global hegemon, the United States, which has dominated the world for the past 70 years, in which its global power is broken and its dominance over Eurasia, something the United States has maintained since the start of the Cold War in the early 1950s, that is coming also to an end.
This is the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki talking about Biden's meeting with Xi Jinping on video phone call.
The movement of China to align with Russia or to
the movement of them to align with Russia, or their proximity of moving closer together, is certainly of great concern to us, as we have expressed, and we are not the only country that has expressed that concern, including many other members of the G7 have expressed exactly that concern. So this is part of the discussion. It has been an ongoing part of the discussion. Expect it certainly would be when the president goes to Europe next week, but we're not in a place at this point to outline the specifics. We're still discussing.
So if you can talk more about, Professor McCoy, what Biden threatened, if it has an effect. He is going to Europe this week. He's speaking with a lot of European nations today, then meeting in Brussels with other NATO members, then going to Poland to hold bilateral talks Friday and Saturday. What this means for Russia and then for Russia and China.
The United States is concerned, I think, in two areas. One, that China will provide weaponry and financial support. And in fact, China can break the financial embargo that the United States is trying to impose upon Russia in order to restrain them in their invasion of Ukraine. And so what Washington is monitoring is flows of weapon and flows of financial support from China to Russia. That's what the United States is trying to restrain. And that the weapons may have a short-term impact. The financial flows a medium-term impact. That's the U.S. concern. But I think we need to sort of analyze the situation in dual tracks. One, focus on the diplomacy, the military activity in Ukraine, the course of the war on the battlefield. Okay, and that may or may not go Putin's way. But underlying that, there is this extraordinary confidence in Moscow and Beijing that the geopolitics of Eurasia are on their side, that because of their alliance and their dominant position in this great landmass that comprises 70% of the world's population and productivity, that it almost inevitably that they are going to emerge as the new centers of global power on the planet. And that, I think, is underlying their boldness and their resistance to Washington's pressure. So we can, in from their perspective, we can provide weapons. We can mount financial pressure. We can even impact the situation on the battlefield by providing anti-tank missiles and handheld weapons that can bring down, like Stinger missiles that can bring down Russian helicopters and aircraft. We can do all that, but that is not material. That's not what's going to matter. They believe, because of the theory of geopolitics, that being the dominant powers in this great Eurasian landmass, that they can slowly break the controls that the United States has imposed over Eurasia since the start of the Cold War, and they can break U.S. global power, and they together can construct a new global order. Every global hegemon, and that's the word that Beijing and Moscow use, every global hegemon for the last 500 years, from the Portuguese to the Spanish, the Dutch, the British, the United States, and now the Chinese, have done one thing in common. They have all dominated Eurasia. Their rise to global power, including the U.S. rise to global power after World War II, was accompanied by dominance over Eurasia. And decline of all of these global powers, including the United States, has been marked by their declining control over Eurasia. And together, Beijing and Moscow are pursuing a strategy that I call, push, push, punch. So they're pushing at these great chains of geopolitical control that the United States has ringed around Eurasia since the Cold War. Naval fleets, air bases, mutual defense pacts. They're pushing slowly at the east and west ends of Eurasia, hoping to strain and break those chains of control that the United States has imposed over Eurasia until, in the succession of these punches, those chains of control snap, U.S. dominance over Eurasia comes to an end, and correspondingly, in the theory of geopolitics, U.S. global power also declines.
So, Professor McCoy, one of the key reasons binding Russia to China, in addition to what you've been talking about, is that Russia is a major energy exporter. China is one of the world's leading energy importers. Put that together with the Wall Street Journal reporting last week, Saudi Arabia is in active talks with Beijing to price some of its oil sales to China in yuan, a move that would dent the U.S. dollar's dominance of the global petroleum market. China buys more than a quarter of the oil that Saudi Arabia exports. If priced in yuan, those sales would boost the standing of China's currency. Can you talk about the significance of both the currency and energy politics?
Sure. One of the foundations of U.S. global powers, right since the end of World War II, has been that the dollar has been the functional global reserve currency. That was set at the Bretton Woods Conference in 1944. In 1971, when President Nixon ended the automatic convertibility of dollars to gold, Saudi Arabia announced that they would keep conducting their petroleum transactions in dollars. And since oil is the most negotiated of all international commodities, if the world is doing its oil business in dollars, that means the dollar has that continuing support as global reserve currency. Since 2015, the Chinese currency has become a part of the international basket of currencies recognized by the International Monetary Fund. And as China's dominance over the global economy grows and it becomes the world's largest economy, the Chinese currency's role in that international economy is going to increase. And once the dollar declines, that is the most negotiable, the most visible part of U.S. global dominance. That global dominance will follow the decline of the dollar downward.
How do you see all of this playing out, Professor McCoy?
Short term, I think that what we're looking at is a kind of a parallel of what happened with the last time China and Russia were allied. In the early 1950s, Mao Zedong went to Moscow. He was a supplicant. He formed an alliance with Joseph Stalin, and Joseph Stalin cashed in that alliance very quickly by using China to enter the Korean War. China fought in Korea for 3 years. It cost them about 40% of China's budget, 200,000 dead Chinese soldiers. We're looking at it as kind of a reprise of that. You know, Putin comes to Beijing in February in the Winter Olympics. He's now the supplicant. He needs China's diplomatic and economic support for his Ukraine invasion. And so at the moment of this very strong alliance, again, and this time Putin attacks, he's sacrificing his budget, his soldiers, all right, in this strategy of pushing and pushing and breaking the U.S. dominance over Eurasia. I see long-term the growing power of China over the Eurasian continent, their Belt and Road Initiative, this $1 trillion development program that now incorporates around 70 nations in Eurasia and Africa, laying down infrastructure, pipelines, railroads, and roads across the whole Eurasian landmass. If this development project succeeds, and it's 10 times the size of the Marshall Plan that the United States used to rebuild Europe after World War II, it's the biggest development scheme in human history. If this scheme works in laying down infrastructure of rails, pipelines, and roads across the Eurasian landmass, and that draws the commerce of Eurasia, home to 70% of the world's population, towards Beijing, then almost as if by natural law, power and prestige and global leadership will flow towards Beijing. And so what we're witnessing is the violent eruptions of a great tectonic shift in global power. As U.S. global power declines, China ascends, power shifts from the West, from Europe and the United States, towards Asia. And we're witnessing then an historic change that is for the, I'd say by 2030, By the end of this decade, it will become clear that U.S. global power is eclipsed, that power has shifted to Beijing on the Eurasian landmass, and they are the new global hegemon. Constructing a new kind of world order, far less concerned with human rights, far less concerned with law, a kind of transactional world order of mutual convenience.
Promoting thiscan'tbehappening.net, and John Grant. John, what's up, man?
Hey, Mike. Well, it's a lovely day here. We have a nice, reasonably warm day for spring is coming.
Well, 17 tornadoes ripped through Texas.
Ooh.
Went on up to Arkansas last night. It's rainy and gloomy today after a beautiful weekend of sun. Who knows what's coming your way? I can't wish enough bad to happen to Pennsylvania. You guys always seem to have the good weather.
You've had enough of bad, pass it on to us.
Well, I think Philadelphia, a lot of geographically challenged Kansans don't realize that the unique thing about Pennsylvania is on the east side of Pennsylvania, the Philadelphia side of Pennsylvania.
Right.
You're really not that far from the ocean. I mean, there might be some.
We got a minor thing like the state of New Jersey between us and the ocean. It's,
Yeah.
I guess an hour drive away.
Yeah, but New Jersey's just a dot, I mean, compared to Pennsylvania, really, isn't it? I mean,
well, that's what Mark Twain said, that New Jersey was the effluent sludge and sewage that came from New York and Philadelphia and collected in New Jersey.
It really hasn't changed, has it?
Right. Poor New Jersey. Born in New Jersey, though. Yeah, hey.
Oh, that explains a lot, right there.
Yeah. No Bergenfield. I was born in the Catholic hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, the same hospital that Ricky Nelson was born in.
Ricky? Oh, no kidding.
Remember the Ozzie and, what is it? Ozzie
and Harriet.
Yeah, of course. Nelson. Ozzie and Harriet Nelson. It was an American family, and their sons were rock stars. It's like,
I think they predated Leave It to Beaver or close to something like that.
Well, I was born in the same hospital as Ricky Nelson, man. Yeah.
That's a claim to fame. That's a claim to fame.
Celebrity, but, close.
Well, it's as close as you're going to get, John. And Western Pennsylvania, listeners, is roughly Pittsburgh, which is sort of the industrialized heartland, and seems to be in the weather path of, Western Pennsylvania seems to suffer more tougher weather than the east part of Pennsylvania, you think?
Probably does, yeah. We are, as you say, closer to the ocean breezes and things like that, I guess. It could be the case,
Because all those tornadoes going up through Texas, Arkansas, we're headed towards that area, well, west of Pittsburgh, but still, I mean, they're, I'm sure they blew themselves out before they got up that far, but
yeah,
it was big news around here. I mean, Texas has got slammed. I mean, literally, there's so many of them they couldn't keep track of. You know what I mean?
Unbelievable.
Like popping up everywhere. Tornadoes in Texas. Somehow, somehow it's fitting for a state like Texas to.
Well, yeah.
I mean, I don't wish it upon anybody, but
in my political position, I agree with that. Especially, you know, why aren't there more tornadoes in Florida? You know, Florida is just as bad as Texas these days, or maybe worse in some respects. My home state, I still consider my home state. But,
yeah, you do.
Anyway. Well, here
so,
we are. You know, the world is a stewing, steaming mess, and here we are. You know,
it is. We're talking about the weather. All right. So
right. Well, we haven't got to the politics yet.
No. Well, let's start off with a little bang here. I think I've got something here for you.
Uh-huh,
if I can get it, so that the listeners, because I'm doing it off the computer. So we'll just see. It's a little. It's like less than 3 minutes.
Okay.
It's my lead to my question I want to ask you.
So it's a little red meat from Mike here. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's go to the original segment. Welcome to Pushback. I'm Aaron Bacci. In recent years, we have been flooded with a wave of fear mongering that supposed Russian interference poses a major threat to Western democracies.
This is not part of American politics. This is not...
That's a Rachel Maddow. Hold on.
You know, partisan warfare between Republicans and Democrats. This is international warfare against our country.
Imagine if FDR had denied that the Japanese attacked us at Pearl Harbor and didn't react.
That's Democrat Richard Nadler.
That's the equivalent. It's a different thing. I mean, no, it's not. It didn't kill anyone. They didn't kill anyone, but they're destroying our country.
Do you really think it's not far?
Not in the amount of violence, but I think in the seriousness, it is very much on par. This country exists to have a democratic system with a small d. That's what the country's all about. And this is an attempt to destroy that. We have...
That was, excuse me, Jerry Nadler of New York. This is Rob Reiner on... February 2018 with MSNBC, Joy Reid. Hold on.
Been invaded in such a subtle way because we don't see planes hitting the buildings. We don't see bombs dropping in Pearl Harbor. But we have been invaded, as Malcolm points out. We are under attack, but we don't feel it. But it's like walking around with high blood pressure, and then all of a sudden you're not aware of it and you drop dead. So it's insidious.
Wow.
It has affected our bloodstream, and if we don't do something about it, and that's why, you know, guys like John Brennan and James Clapper are running around with their hair on fire, because they're trying to wake people up to tell them that we have to do something about it. We have to protect ourselves, and if we don't, our 241 years of democracy and self-governance will start to collapse. On top of the U.S.,
wow.
Russia, and other main accusers.
Okay, huh? So that was... a clip pulled out by
right.
Aaron Mattat at the Gray Zone, another gang of guys who do some great journalism, as well as this can't be happening. And that was a most – it's a recent thing. And they're on this Russiagate. They've been on it for a couple years, well, several years, and pointing out how that this influences – it's been a longstanding, what everyone call it, campaign by, I think some people would call it the deep state, to vilify and justify a new Cold War. And I just wanted to throw that in the mix here today because...
Yeah, I think you're right on time with that. I mean, those are like Chicken Little. The sky is falling. The sky is falling. Quick, do something. Yeah, that's coming from a lot of American voices. I just heard, you may have heard this on Amy Goodman, Alfred McCoy recently interviewed.
I just played it.
Okay, yeah, I just watched and listened to it 10 minutes ago. I think he's got it. I think he's got it nailed. And, you know, I've been talking for months about, you know, we're facing epical change and all this stuff. Well, what he's focused on is that this is the China and Russia representing what's called Eurasia. And in Alfred McCoy's construction, Eurasia contains 70% of the world's population, and that all empires, you know, have an arc, and ours certainly has an arc, and the Trump episode certainly exacerbated the decline in the United States. It's going great guns now. So, you know, Russia and China know this, and they're taking advantage of it. They aren't fools. And, you know, the United States is facing, a brand new confrontation, a brand new conflict in the world. You know, we decided that we were going to dominate the globe after World War II, after our imperialism started in, say, 1898, you know, back with T.R. Roosevelt and all that. You know, and it's like what goes around comes around. And so we're now facing, a declining empire's problems that other people, you know, see our weakness and they want a piece of it. And that's what we're facing, you know. And, you know, McCoy expresses it, you know, very clearly and it makes a lot of sense. And, you know, that's what Rob Reiner's talking about. They're coming for us. Well, that's true. They are coming for us. And and why is that? You know, we stood up and said, hey, don't fuck with us. We run the world. And they're all of a sudden, wait a minute. No, I'm not sure about that. I think maybe if we play our cards right, we could end up running the world. And according to McCoy, that's going to happen by 2030. You know, by 2030, the United States will have accepted its position, you know, as not number one in the world. I mean, that's a big, big deal. You know, talk about American exceptionalism and, Rob Reiner, who made the movie about, Jack Nicholson and Tom Cruise. You can't handle the truth, you know. You remember
that? Oh, that's
in,
right. He did.
What
he
was
did
that movie
that,
called?
Yes.
Well, a great scene that's quoted by everybody under the sun. You know, you can't handle the truth. You know. Well, maybe the United States can't handle the truth. You know, the truth is we're declining, and there ain't nothing we can do about it. We're certainly doing everything ass backwards about it. We're, you know, not addressing climate change. We're electing clowns like Donald Trump, and you know that only exacerbates the decline. And we fight amongst ourselves. We're polarized, you know. And I just looked up what aboutism, and it's all over the internet here. I didn't realize it, but I've been arguing with people over 2-3 weeks here. And I didn't realize there was a label for this argument. It's called whataboutism, you know. In this case of this invasion of Ukraine. Well, my argument is, yes, the United States has done terrible things. It's imperial history. It's done war crimes, whatever you want to call it. But the United States is not responsible for the invasion of Ukraine. And so The arguments I've been getting back at me is, well, what about Iraq? Well, what about Afghanistan? What about Vietnam? You know,
right.
And so the point of the whataboutism argumentation, and you know, it's like ad hominem. It's an argument kind of style. You know, you diffuse an argument by saying, well, okay, yeah, that was evil, but something you did 20 years ago was much more evil, so therefore it's okay, you know? No, I don't buy that at all, you know? It's like, yeah, the Russian invasion of Ukraine is okay because America's bad, you know? It's like, no, I mean, it's an effective argument if you want to, you know, diffuse your opposite's argument, and it does.
Right.
You know, it leaves it in this amoral mishmash of, like, everybody's evil, so what the fuck is the difference? Invade whoever you like, you know? It doesn't matter. Morality doesn't matter. Huh?
Well, okay. I'm laughing.
That was my little riff. Okay.
Well, I like it. I like the words amoral, you know.
Yeah, right. Great word.
It's an ad hominem. It's words I wouldn't think to put in there. They're more accurate than what I would do.
Point is the whataboutism, you know, throws a question of something's morality into an area of amoral. Morality is not an issue here because you guys did it too. So what the fuck? Anything goes, you know? I mean, isn't that what the argument's about? But anyway, maybe we're getting ahead of our audience here. I don't know.
Yeah, I think we are. It's a thing that's floating around among and between, for lack of better terms, anti-imperialist people or mm-hmm. anti-U.S. imperialist people, and mm-hmm. Maybe anti-war people, including, mm-hmm. I would say most pacifists would not participate in this, religious mm-hmm. pacifists particularly. Would not participate uh-huh. in the argument because, I mean, they're
right.
self-destructive on their own. I mean, they don't have any choice but to. I mean, they don't have any choice. I've summed that up from being with them, and I like, you know, don't get me wrong, but by their logic, there's no way except spend your life in prison, really, or to die trying to stop war. I mean, it's a horrible dilemma. It's very depressing. I mean, I can't see how people would, particularly Christians, would go to that in a sense of deep, out of anxiety over the nonstop commitment to violence of any sort, you know, of humans on humans. I mean, it's a horrible reckoning with, you know, the history of human civilization, if you can call it that, mm-hmm. Development. But, you know, for me, I think the argument about whataboutism is mm-hmm. it's absolutely true, but it lacks any, you know, it lacks any context of resilience, mm-hmm. of how do you survive in this situation. I
sure,
used this in the
sure.
green room with you.
Right.
The wonders of technology, even though it's corporate, driven, advertisement driven, corporate owned by, you know, people, YouTube, all these things, Meta, Facebook, all these entities are all owned by people who have become billionaires and in their own right, quiet oligarchs of a sort that we don't know much about. But they allow us to use this stuff, their technology, to communicate. And I think it's a big thing. I hate to sound like a Republican, but I think the deep state or a QAnon person, or worse, a QAnon. But I think the deep state of many different countries, not just the United States, have been playing games with media disinformation and misinformation. Yeah. And I think they're doing it quite successfully. This example, those audio clips that I played came from 2018. I mean, this has been, this is since Hillary said, well, the Russians ruined it for the Democrats. So that's why Trump came out. That was, you know, I mean, it's neither here nor there. I mean, it really was the battleground states, and Trump and Steve Bannon and his gang was smart enough to move in the closing weeks of the campaign for presidency to go seriously into those battleground states and say the right reactionary backward things and outrageous things that Donald Trump is a trademark of, to basically swing votes to the, that's why Trump went. And Hillary Clinton is just a lousy, everybody knows she's part of the oligarchy. You know, I guess they thought Donald Trump was just a backyard version of an oligarch so we can let him in because someday I'll be like him too, you know. I'm going to be a millionaire, you know, maybe have my own TV show. Maybe I'll be real popular and run and become president of Ukraine. Why don't you tell us about what you discovered Netflix or?
On Netflix for the last couple nights, I've been binge watching little half-hour shows of Servant of the People. It's called Servant of the People with Volodymyr Zelensky, the current president of Ukraine, in a TV series production from 2015 called Servant of the People, which is a comedy, you know, sometimes rather broad comedy of, you know, a school teacher, a simple, beloved school teacher who is talking to his students one day in history. He's a history teacher, and he just goes off on a rant about corruption in Ukraine, and you know, and this is, and he just goes off, and he's using, you know, and they use beeps in the show, you know, beep beep, you know, so he's, every other word is a curse word, fuck, shit, whatever, you know, they translate it for us in the subtitles here, but in the original it's beep 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 beep, you know.
Well, is he teaching what? What level?
He teaches history
grade?
In a high school.
In a high school. I guess that's probably acceptable behavior. I think a lot of conservatives out here would go screaming about the teacher using profanity, but never
well,
mind.
They're upset about it here. They're very upset about it. You know, and as I say, the censors have been beeping it in the original. So in the Ukraine culture, you know, saying all those words, it's not like HBO here or our show. You can't say that stuff. So the point is, one of his students gets his iPhone out and videotapes his rant and then releases it on the internet, and it goes viral, right? Well, he runs into trouble with the principal, et cetera, et cetera. They put him on the carpet and abuse him and all this. But then it goes viral, and somebody, you know, everybody loves it. This guy's speaking the truth, you know. It is a corrupt cesspool we live in here, right? Somebody decides in his class to put a GoFundMe thing online, and, you know, they need 2 million, whatever their local currency is, in order to register as a candidate for the presidency. Well, it's not quite certain how that happens, but the students and all get the money, and he's put in for the president. It's sort of a fluke, right? And he kind of forgets about it, and then he wins, right? That's the shtick here, conceit. And, you know, some of it is just hilarious. You know, he comes to work, insists on coming to work in a taxi instead of a stretch limo and things like that. And, you know, he fires half of his staff, you know, some are for painting his toenails, and they're all this decadent stuff, you know. And it's ridiculous. And so he's just a simple man, and he's trying to get through this corruption. And the funniest scene so far is there's this guy who's his manager, and this is a political hack, you know, corrupt sort of fellow, and he's guiding this new naive president through his paces. Well, he also knows the other guy, the guy that's just leaving and lost the election. And the guy who lost the election, I assume, is supposed to be Petro Poroshenko, who is the president between Yanukovych, right?
That
2014 was knocked out of the box by the riots, the 30-day or 90 days of riots, or the U.S. coup, whichever side you like. You know,
it's very confusing. I think it's the Russians.
Well, some people want to say it's a U.S. cynical.
Let me help, because I had to go. I had to learn this.
Okay,
The guy Luka, they're very similar names, but it begins with an L.
Well, Lukashenko, that's in Belarusia.
And Poroshenko, there's one of them too. He came in after.
Poroshenko was the president of before Zelensky. Zelensky beat him, I think.
Yeah. Oh, there's actually three. Did you know that? There's three.
I'm lost track. But the point is, I don't know who this character in the play represents, right? But he's the guy, and this, of course, was made in 2015, pre-Trump. But, in other words, they're trying to get the new president into its office. But the old president won't leave, right? He says, I don't want to leave. I won. It's a phony election. I'm not leaving, you know. And so this manager guy who has moved from the old guy to the new guy, goes in to talk to his old friend, you know, would-be Poroshenko, whoever it's supposed to be. And the guy just breaks down. He's crying. He says, I don't want to leave. I just don't want to leave. I like doing this. I don't want to do it. I want to stay here. Please, let me stay here. No. I'm sorry, Petro. You got to go, man. You got to go, you know. And it's just hilarious because, you know, you can see Donald Trump sort of doing kind of the same histrionics. You know, like, wait a minute. I want to stay here. I like being here, you know. And, it just cracks me up. I watch it a couple of times. This poor guy is just a blubbering idiot, you know. He's supposed to be the president of Ukraine. He just, I just like it. I want to be here. Please. just cracked me up.
Is that how it ends, the episode?
No, it ends, and again, because the guy, it's very well artistically put together. There's flashbacks now and then, and he goes back to a parallel flashback where the new young history teacher is going to replace some old ancient derelict historian teacher that they're running out because he's old, he's ancient, right? And so he won't leave this classroom. So our man goes in and works it out with him and respects him. And by the end of it, the old guy says, okay, I'll move on, I'll pass it on to you, you're a good guy. And so he facilitates, you know, the guy gracefully leaving. So he then, in the shtick, conceit of the piece, he goes into the old president who's crying in his beard, he wants to stay. He finally goes in and they make peace, and he says, okay, I'll leave, you know. But the point is the comedy of it. It's just so funny. The guy, you know, does not want to leave, you know. And, man, this is my sandbox. I want to stay here. I like it here, you know.
Yeah.
It's just very funny. And of course,
Is this Netflix or
It's on
Amazon
Netflix. It's called Servant of the People, and there's one season of it. I don't know. I'm up to the fifth half hour show, and it's also it has a family. He lives with his mother and father. He's divorced, and he has a young boy who's with his ex-wife. And so the family life where he lives is something out of The Honeymooners. I mean, it reminds me of, you know, the whole tradition of American sort of family husband and wife comedy teams from, you know, classics of The Honeymooners, Jackie Gleason, you know, on down. And his father is like Jackie Gleason, he's got some scam going. Now his son is the president. So he's ordering all this stuff. They're redesigning their apartment into, it looks like Versailles, you know. And the corruption, even in his own family, is like going over the top. And so it's just very funny. And in fact, his very election, this teacher, this, you know, mild-mannered teacher, humble teacher, at the beginning, you see the first shot of this opening segment of the series has a shot at night of Maiden Square, which, of course, is where the 90-day riots happen. They call it Maiden Riot. Well, it's very famous in the middle of Kyiv. And so he's showing, and then the camera backs off, and you're on a balcony overlooking Maiden Square, and then there's these three suited, ominous-looking guys in suits, and the colors there are very blue and dark and ominous, and they're all cutting deals. They're all talking about, well, yeah, we'll go with this guy. And so they're deciding it's to their benefit to go with this history teacher who's on the list with 20 other candidates or something, right? And somehow it seems to me they have finagled with it and arranged for his election. So the election of this would-be wonderful, non-corrupt, naive history teacher as president is done through a corrupt act. It seems to me, at least that's my reading of it, you know. And so the corruption is so incredible, and it's, of course, a leftover corruption from Yanukovych period, you know. And in fact, when he goes to the presidential palace, right, they're using Yanukovych's beautiful wooden mansion. It's just stunningly beautiful, you know. And he has a zoo, and he's gonna take his son to the zoo there, you know, on the Yanukovych castle. So they're using the accoutrements of Yanukovych's corrupt reign, which ended in 2014, you know, with those riots. You know, as part of the mise-en-scene of this, you know, comic little series. So it's really, really interesting.
That's
high
amazing.
Production values. It's something, you know, it looks like an HBO production. It's really, it's interesting. It's interesting as a, you know, especially when you realize the guy was then literally elected
to be president. That is, to me, I'm sorry to interrupt you because it's fascinating that what you're describing.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I agree. Well,
I mean, it's tragic on a Shakespearean scale that
I don't think anyone
has come to grips with that.
And the media, my point is the media, this media monster that we're all hooked into on our televisions and social media, I mean, it's an assault from, you know, every direction, like unprecedented in history. That, in this case, is thoroughly woven into the politics of it all. You know, it's politics has gone from the real world into the internet and media world, and it's just... the implications of it, you know, this war is the first wired war. It's unbelievable. So the fact that it evolved out of a TV comedy, you know.
It's like it comes from a TV. Well, I mean.
You mentioned sort of Shakespeare. Shakespeare's early plays are comedies like the TV series.
Yeah.
Well, by the end of his life, he's writing these dark, dark, dark tragedies. Well. You know, the comedy in this case has gone to a very dark, dark tragedy, and the same guy's the president of it both. You know, it's like,
well, there's tragedy in the comedies too. You know,
sure.
Much
no,
about
right.
nothing. I mean, there's
of course you're right.
I mean, people die in them too, unnecessarily. But there is this thing for me. It's like, how does it? This is a question I had with Trump.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now I'm not going to accuse Zelensky of being so blatantly dishonest, but I don't know enough about him to say that. But I will say this:
I don't either. Yeah.
How can he get in front of a camera a few days ago? And he's so. Yeah. I mean, he's an actor to the max. I mean, that's how he's pulling this off. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
But he says if we had been members of NATO before this, this would never have happened. Now, why would he? I heard him say it. I saw the translation. It seemed like, you know, I mean, this is the kind of thinking. I don't think the guy's up for the job. I mean, he's up for the drama. He's up for
What do you have against him saying that?
Well, because everyone knows that Poland and all the NATO members have ballistic missile capabilities where they could launch within minutes. It brings it even closer towards a nuclear exchange. Right. I mean, with between NATO and Russia, I mean, it just puts everything on a tighter hair trigger than it already is. And to me, I think that's ridiculous. You know, I don't think Russia's entitled to any other countries, but around it. But Ukraine is certainly it's always been for thousands of years. It's a trade route, and I think in this case it's oil and gas, and I think that's probably what affected some of the behavior of it, and the fact that it seems like. The amount of arms going in, I mean, how can you say, okay, well, they're not a member of NATO, but they're being armed like they're a member of NATO. I mean, it's sort of, to me, it's like, what's wrong with the idea of rolling back NATO? I mean, what the hell? What's that all about? I mean,
because Putin's actions show, we're all talking about this is a return of the Cold War. Well, of course it is. You know, it's the same struggle. It's just that, the Soviet Union collapsed, and then it was replaced by this public-private, gangster government of Vladimir Putin. At least that's my description of it. Now they're feeling their oats, especially with China and this whole idea of Alfred McCoy's inevitable decline and. The axis of world domination, world control is going to be in Eurasia, that the United States, this arc is over, grow up, pay attention, you're losing it here. Whether they'd pursued NATO or whether they'd let NATO die with the Soviet Union, I don't think that would have affected Vladimir Putin's power-hungry, if you want to call it that, feelings now, whether NATO existed or not. I think Poland, whether it was part of NATO or not, Poland wanted to develop more of a Western European sort of style. That's what your Ukraine wants, apparently. That's what everything about this TV series points up, because it has a lot of abstract ideas about democracy versus corruption and all that stuff. As I said, he sleeps, and Socrates and I forgot the other philosopher. Two philosophers are talking about him and democracy and all these things while he's asleep. And another scene, he turns around, the light shifts a little bit in the scene, and there's Abraham Lincoln in the corner, because they want him to read this version of the Gettysburg Address at his first meeting with the people, And Abraham Lincoln tells him, look, I know it was a great speech for me. It worked, and, I can see why. But listen, be yourself, like you went in that rant. You've already done you've already gone viral on the YouTube. This is Abraham Lincoln telling him this, right? Just be yourself, man. Your authority, your power is just be yourself. And he does that. And then while he's over there talking to his cabinet, or all these corrupt fat cats in the cabinet that he's moved in as president. It does this thing where he's looking at them, he's being introduced to them and who they are, and there's sort of, as an aside, the light will suddenly shift, and there's Che Guevara telling them, don't believe a goddamn word these people are saying, Che Guevara. And then we get this version of he went around and he rips into all these fat cats, as Che Guevara wanted him to do, but then it turns out that was only in his imagination, and he really didn't do that. So they play around with all this stuff in a very interesting way.
Well, certainly,
because, well, you know, all these issues are at play here, democracy, what's left of it, and things like that.
It certainly sounds like it's more enlightening than The Apprentice.
Yes, well, I think, yeah, exactly. Here you got a guy who's, you know, a humble historian, and, you know, he comes in, and the point is his humility, whereas the point of Donald Trump was his ability to blow himself up and fire you and humiliate you and, in live TV, you know. That was his claim to fame, you know. It's a different position here, you know. It's a, by the way, there's a scene in there where that's exactly a parallel of my wife's experience. She was at a teacher in Norristown High School when George Bush Sr. was coming to speak. Right? And they wanted her art department, she's an art teacher, to make a book that would be behind the president when he spoke there at 9 a.m. the next morning, right? Well, Luann, being a subversive one that she is, decided, okay, what are we going to put on this history book? Or no, what are we going to put on this book that they least want to talk in front of? History. She puts on history. Well, you know, and she thought this is her coup. You know, she had the president speaking a history book behind him, you know, and all the issues of history and whatnot. So the president's man comes in the morning at 8 o'clock and sees it and says, paint over history and put math there, right? We don't want the president speaking in front of history. History's too controversial. Math is not controversial, right? So they have to do
that.
They put, well, here it happens that the same situation, how does it go here? He's a history teacher, right? And they're going they're going to some big sluggo apparatchnik comes in and tell him, you know, they're going to have to do something with his class. Well, why? What are you going against history? Well, they favor math just exactly the same way they did with my wife in The Power Here. It just, I forgot the exact details, but it was just floored me, you know, that history was deemed, when it comes to power, history was something you didn't want to be associated with at all. You wanted to be associated with math. Because math is apolitical, math is about numbers and money or whatever you want to call it. And it was really funny to see that overlap with a real incident that my wife was involved in. With our leaders here. You know.
Yeah.
They don't want much to do with history because history is a minefield. You walk through it and kaboom, you know, you're going to hit something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, honestly, I mean, I don't know. We just don't get people out here. George Bush never comes to our schools, let alone Joe Biden or anybody else. I just got to be honest. I mean, the only ones, Bob Dole might roll out every once in a while.
Well, that's because he lived out there. That's why he came out there.
Yeah, they come back. That's the problem. They come back.
He didn't come back.
I used to say that once they go to Washington, D.C., they'll never be back.
Right.
And then, to a certain extent, that's true. But, I can name him. Senator Pat Roberts is a noteworthy. His
wife, it's like they used to say, once you went to St. Louis and saw the elephant, you'll never be back to the farm or something like that.
Yes. But they do come back. The ones that just don't make it. Senator Pat Roberts, after a distinguished, I don't know, 300 years in the Senate, on the Senate Agriculture Committee, he finally retired. And he openly campaigned, I believe, in his last campaign in Kansas was – he got ridiculed, and I was one of them. I did my best to point out that he campaigned in a recliner. He slept in a recliner at a golf in a rental. He owns the house. It's by the golf course and the lake. Okay, and he rents out the house. He rents out the house. Now, this goes in line with his wife, who is a big real estate dealer, I think, in Virginia or West Virginia. That's where he's really retired at now, living with his money-making wife.
West Virginia.
But Senator Pat Roberts, I've met him a couple times, and that's as famous as it gets with me. I met Pat Roberts a couple times. And he said, I rent that when I'm and I come back and sleep in his rentor, his tenant's recliner when he's campaigning. And was, I mean, that's – and he, I don't think – the joke was that he never got out of the recliner. I mean, he never saw the guy. I mean, he just he's campaigning for the reelection to the Senate from a recliner, a lazy boy, you know. And it caught on, and he didn't deny that, by the way. He's got a great sense of humor. He never denied that. Most of his campaign was from that that lazy boy.
From the Barca lounger there, right?
So people, I mean, so your politicians, I mean, Kansas, it's a netherworld. It's not really real.
At least that's the way it feels when you live there.
Well, at the beginning of this Ukraine thing, you know, I thought, now, Kansas is sort of like Ukraine. I mean, we do a lot of wheat, and, you know.
Well, you're the breadbasket.
But we're not.
Too.
Ukraine, obviously, 44 Christ, million people. And
you probably grow as much wheat
and,
as they do over there. Yeah.
Well, ten times the population of Kansas. But it's cities. I mean, they're obviously more cultured. I mean, if they got a comedy show like that, then they elect this character.
I think
Putin just picked this time because he knows this is the earliest time or the last time he would be able to pull something off like this?
Well, I think that's a
what
good question, timing-wise. Why did he pick now?
Yeah.
I don't know if there's anything particularly set it off that I'm aware of. I don't know. He just decided. I don't know. It's a good question. Yeah. The fact that he really, what's interesting, of course, is that, you know, Biden and his intelligence operatives, said all along that they're going to do this. And, I mean, I thought it was a bluff. I didn't think he was going to do it. Biden said he's going to do it. They're going to do it big time. They're going to stomp that place. And they did. That's what they're doing.
What they're doing, right?
Well, I mean, you know, compared to the intelligence in Iraq, I mean, the intelligence here was accurate. Whatever.
Yeah. Well, I wonder sometimes if he chose now because he knew that. Well, McCoy talked about it the end of the first hour. He said that in that clip about he used the example of the Olympics, and there was a 5,000 plus word statement, joint statement put out the two. I mean, that was a remarkable time for that, and that was just a few months ago. So maybe that I don't know. If Professor McCoy pinpointed that as Putin decided at that point that the ties would be strong enough that they wouldn't break with China if he invaded Ukraine.
Yeah, I think I heard somewhere that someone speculated that Putin had asked China had asked Putin to hold off the invasion until after the Olympics, because they didn't want to distract from the Chinese Olympics.
Right.
I don't know. But the timing question is interesting. You know, why now? I mean, certainly if Donald Trump had been reelected, do you think he would have invaded Ukraine or what? I don't know.
Donnie is so fucking erratic. I don't think he would he would know himself until you ask him.
Right.
I mean, in all honesty, I mean, the guy would he could impulsively, it depends on what general or who was in the room with him and cheered him on at over what, I mean, that it, You know, and I think there's a point, and I wish I'd link to the site, link to the writer. He was a journalist, I think, in Finland, I think. And he wrote some sort of thing that's making some little shockwaves through it, but pointing out that, you know, who is the U.S. to be getting involved in this, in the expansion of NATO? And he went through a history, you know, of its growth, and then points out that, you know, you guys can't, and then he ends it up somehow pointing out that you guys can't even, you know, take care of your own coup plotters, you know, your own rioters in your own government building. You know?
Right.
He's got a point. I mean, Trump is walking away.
Well, you're getting back to the what-ism sort of argument here.
Is it, well, I mean, is it what-about-ism? Is that what-about, I mean, I guess I'm pretty sure this writer was from Finland, which is an interesting country to be in the middle of, I guess. You know, I don't know.
Well, Finland went to war with Russia before World War II, in a horrible war. It was horrible. I've seen a novel about it. It was said to be gruesome. You know, some of the and so that's why Finland stayed out of NATO, and as well as Sweden. But Finland's right next to Russia. Finland decided, you know, for the reasons that they're criticizing the expansion of NATO, you know, Finland decided we are going to be neutral. We fought these people. We don't want to fight them again, so we're going to remain neutral. But Finland is now ready to join because of Putin's actions. So, I mean, Putin, you know, if his actions are meant to push back NATO, he did exactly the wrong thing and shot himself in both feet, because he has bolstered and reinforced NATO like nothing has ever done it before. You know, Sweden and Finland are going to join, from what I read. This is what war does. Everybody then beefs up, and you know, we gotta raise our you know, military budget. It's insane.
There's electronic. There's electronic and surveillance of the nuclear stores that are shared. I think there's inventory control of the nuclear warheads in both countries, and I think I think IAEA or some there's a international inspection team. I mean, by cutting off relations with Russia in that to that depth, I mean, leads towards more. You know, I mean, it doesn't take much, remember, you know, WMDs and the allegation thereof. And
well,
you know,
this is why in Vets for Peace we say, you know, wars are easy to start and hard to stop, because it's true. I mean, you know, once you start them, you know, they begin escalating. Everybody, you know, is protecting themselves, and before you know it, you know, you're all wrapped up in this thing. And as my experience comes, especially when my experience with El Salvador, is that the, you know, maybe not, it's never say the only thing, but a significant factor in ending these wars is stalemate and war weariness. In other words, they're talking about stalemate. They're, you know, they're saying if Ukraine can fight hard enough to create a stalemate, then there is room for negotiations. But if somebody wins, you know, if somebody's winning, there's no hope for getting out of the war. It's just going to keep going until a stalemate's reached, and then both sides decide they're just completely weary and fed up with all the killing and the destruction. And then, you know, then you can get a negotiation going. But, you know, I don't think the stalemate's been reached yet by any means, you know, if it ever is reached.
Right.
I don't know. Stomp the place until it's done, you know.
And your experiences with these geographically small Central American countries, too.
Well,
I mean,
different animal, of course.
Yeah, it's the possibilities for a guerrilla war in there is
of course.
It's not unending for a long, long time. You know, I could take it.
Right, and this thing that Alex is it, or McCoy, Alan McCoy or Al McCoy, whatever. Alex
McCoy. What's McCoy?
Okay.
Alfred.
I'm sorry, Alfred McCoy. You know, as he's saying, this process of the ascendancy of China and Russia as the hegemons, I think that's the key word here, in Eurasia, it's a process that, you know, takes a while. It's not going to happen overnight, and we're only kind of in the beginnings of it. But he's suggesting that that dynamic is, the wheels are set in motion for that, and that the way he described it, there's really not too much the United States can do except for be graceful in accepting this. You know, and of course, we know that the United States doesn't do that. You know, we don't work towards soft landings. You know, what we do is crisis management. You know, it has to hit the fan.
Professor McCoy breezed through that little bit. For me, I was sort of like, oh, I think he ended up with, well, basically, a large part of the world won't have basic human liberty. I think that was how it ended.
Yeah.
But, you know, to me, it's sort of like, at the same time, he just skipped over the potential of possibly blowing the shit out of each other in a nuclear war exchange, you know. So I just...
Yeah, just flip by that.
About the old guy.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I wondered that about the old guy. What he said, I said, "Oh, he's thinking in the big picture." And I'm like, "I'm not. I wonder. Maybe we're not. Maybe we are still in the tiny minority. But you know, it, certainly the old black and white newsreels of the Cuban Missile Crisis that we can see on YouTube every day. It seemed like the population was a little bit more worried than here in 21st century America. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think that's true. I think you're right. When the Cuban Missile Crisis, we were in a panic. But I think, you know, maybe we think it's all going to sort out and somehow we're going to be fine and we'll have our exceptional lives and we can mow our lawns and go about our lives. I don't know. You know, at what point does the shit really land on Americans, you know, and global warming and all these things that we put off and, you know, waste our money, hose it out for wars instead of doing infrastructure so bridges fall down and things like that. You know, at what point does this really impact on our lives? And at that point, you know, do we revert to the dominant position in the world of a authoritarian, tribal-oriented government in which the rich get richer and the poor get, you know, treated like untouchables in India and everybody just kicks them out of the way when you get that cold-blooded culture, you know, of, you know, people that have been adjusted to extreme poverty and therefore don't see it and they just live their good life. I don't know, you know, I don't know. All this stuff is going on, you know. It's like living in interesting times, you know. We do live in interesting times.
Right. John Grant. Right on, brother.
Mike Cadell, my man. Okay.
All right, well, I hope you enjoyed this Can't Be Happening Tuesday.
Always enjoy it.
CanBeHappening.net.
Good luck with the weather out there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, hey, the Antarctic is like 90 degrees. Check it out tomorrow. Weather on Wednesday. Thank you, bye.
Good. Bye-bye.